my late teens was when the expressway was being built around Chicago. There were about four of us, I guess, or five. One of the things we used to do was we used to go on the expressway, which was three or four lanes wide, and we used to double up and then drive the minimum all the way in and all the way out, piss people off behind us until the cops got us. I like to drive anyhow. Despite the fact that I like to drive and I've driven a whole lot in my lifetime, there are two points in time where I really get nervous driving. One of those is during registration in the first week of class in the fall semester, when there are a lot of people around this town that don't know what the hell they're doing, where they can and can't pull out on the State Street safely. Right. You know, those kinds of things. So when you should go to the light, when you shouldn't. What's a one-way and what isn't. And the other period of time is right around now. When you come on now, Tim, I'm just bullshitting. The other period of time is about this time of year. The first snowfall of any substance. First time there's ice on the roads, and everybody has forgotten over the summer what that means in terms of safety. So I understand that if you're going north particularly, that's that time of year, so be careful driving. I'd like to see you back here to take the exam a week from Friday. And so if you're traveling off on a holiday, be careful. If you're driving and if you're flying northwest, pick your pilot carefully. Nevertheless, we have some work to do before we can leave, and that deals with the idea of psychosis and antipsychotic medications. The paradigm, as it started to develop, was all about blockade of dopamine receptors. And it came down then that psychosis or antipsychotic activity was all about some sort of teeter-totter or we're on some sort of knife blade edge between normalcy and psychotic activity. And that there were parts of the limbic system that were around basically as brakes or counterweight or whatever you want to talk about, however you want to talk about it, in terms of whether or not we were going to get psychotic. That is, as you sit there, all of you can get psychotic. You all have psychotic tendencies. Why aren't you psychotic? Because you haven't had chemo yet. But trust me, it'll be there. Why aren't you psychotic? Because we've got these built-in negatives, these built-in brakes. But these brakes, these antipsychotic tendencies that are counterweighting or balancing are going crazy, have both positive, that is IPSP, EPSP, and negative, that is IPSP influences. That is, the amount of anti that we see over here is the result of stimulation and inhibition itself. So it's like we have a little, if you can picture this, we have a little teeter-totter over here between positives and negatives to determine the correct amount of anti that we're supposed to have. And on that littler teeter-totter, the big negative is all about dopamine. that, the more dopamine that there is around, the more negative the influence is here, and thus the less anti we have, and we start becoming psychotic. It's a math question. If you have only one negative, it's negative. But if you have two negatives, what does it turn into? A positive. Okay? So dopamine's influence in the limbic system, particularly coming from these two nerve tracts that I talked about on Monday, is all about negatively impacting that counterweight and producing psychotic activity. Too much dopamine. So we've got two negatives, right, which equals A. But now, chemically, we're throwing in a third negative. We are blocking these dopaminergic receptors, which are what variety again, by the way?
You want to flip the coin? Do you want to know D2? Thank you.
D2 receptors, right? And as we block the D2 receptors, less dopaminergic influence on this negative, which means more weight on that side, pushing us toward antipsychotic activity. It's a third negative. Okay? So we've got one negative here. We got a second negative here that is influenced by dopamine. More dopamine, more negative, all right, which equals positive as we take weight off of this side because of the negativity. But now we're throwing in a blocking agent, a third negative, says less dopaminergic activity, less negativity here, means more positivity here, which means we go to antipsychotic. And that will be an essay question on the next exam. How is that grabbing? That was the paradigm, the thought. And so as I suggested on Monday, antipsychotic drugs were all about dopaminergic blockade, specifically dopaminergic blockade at D2 receptors. Because after all, if we're nonspecific and we also block D1 receptors, we would get a lot of Parkinson effects and what we call extrapyramidal side effects. Right? Okay? Now, in addition, these what we call old style or classical antipsychotic drugs, of which the main category were the phenothiazine. By the way, Dr. Lipstadt talked about all the various varieties of phenothiazines and all. Is it Dr. Lipstadt? Okay. What that means chemically. We also found a lot of other issues, side effects, if you will. I mean, they were effective, but in addition to the extrapyramidal issues, most of these drugs had other things that they were doing in the CNS, presumably, again, because of their ability to block dopamine receptors of one sort or another. I talked about the negative impact on the hypothalamus in terms of temperature control, right? Tend to lower the hypothalamic thermostat and tend to be a little bit cooler in terms of body temperature. You tend to be more sensitive to cold. You want everything hot. Some of them tended to be sedative, reducing reticular activating system activity. Particularly the aliphatic types tend to be sedative, cause a lot of sleepiness. One of the other things that happened as a side effect, I've listed down at the bottom of that first sheet, of the handout. You may or may not remember this from our general discussion of the central nervous system. But this is what's down at the first sheet of the handout. And I'll just go through it briefly. It's It's letter B at the bottom of the first page. Okay? And this is the graphical depiction. Notice the word up here at the top. Dopamine. What we're looking at is an axis for the anterior pituitary. We'll talk more about it next semester. But the axis we're looking at runs through those cells in the anterior pituitary known as mammotrophic cells. As cells that are responsible for the secretion of a substance that we call prolactin. Now, prolactin levels in general are quite low. As you sit there, as a female, your levels are about half a tick higher than the male that's sitting next to you. But even at that, we're talking real low levels. But during pregnancy, prolactin levels tend to start to increase, and they get extreme during the last month of pregnancy. And prolactin is all about stimulation of the breast alveolar tissue toward milk manufacture, as the name implies. It's all about getting the enzymes together and the apparatus together to produce milk once birth occurs. Tissue development and supportive tissues, ductal tissues and all that's all under estrogenic progestin influence, but the whole idea of milk production itself is prolactin's baby. As you sit there, unless you are pregnant, prolactin's levels are kept really low by the influence of a compound, a chemical messenger coming from the hypothalamus, known as prolactin release inhibitory hormone, PRIH. This comes from the arcuate nucleus. Remember I talked about the hypothalamus. You could think of it like a fruit bowl or dessert bowl, ice cream bowl that's stuck up under the bottom of the forebrain, right? Remember me saying that? The arcuate nucleus is basically that little base that dish rests on, this little projection coming down from the base of the hypothalamus. Anyhow, the arcuate nucleus gets stimulated by dopamine, and the neurons of that nucleus produce prolactin release inhibitory hormone, among other things, to keep prolactin levels down. And hopefully you're about two steps ahead of me here. If it's under dopaminergic control, what occurs as we block dopamine receptors? Lack of dopamine influence says less prolactin release inhibitory hormone coming out of that hypothalamus. We take the brakes off of prolactin release from the mammotrophic cells. We get excessive prolactin. In the male, that results in a condition known as gynecomastia, which is the fancy way of saying, look it, I have breasts. I forget what show it was. Maybe what's the show where it's all the nerds and the one good-looking chick?
Yes.
Big Bang Theory. I think I was a show that he called the man boobs. Okay, gynecomastia. As in gynecologist, feminine mastia boobs. Okay? How would I say this tactfully? Led to compliance issues. I'm developing boobs. Why am I developing boobs, Doc? Because you're psychotic and I've got you on a medication. That's why. Well, if you want to influence some male's psychosis, grow boobs on it. But now you're hallucinating. You're not seeing those. Need more medication. Career compliance issues. Same thing in the female. Only not quite the same issue. In the female, what happened was a condition called galactorrhea. Female already usually has boobs. Now what we've got are functioning boobs, period, big time. Galactorrhea also led to compliance issues. So while extrapyramidal movement issues were one source of a problem, there were also other sources of problems. There was the sedation. There were things like this that occurred commonly. Another thing, as I may have indicated, an alpha blockade. There were all sorts of issues with particularly orthostatic hypotension with some of these compounds. They typically, because they are kites, are anti-muscarinic and or antihistaminic. So with anti-muscarinic, there were some eyesight problems maybe drying of the oral pharyngeal cavity and coughing. Issues with GI activity. Consider that constipation, slowing down as they're anti-muscarinic. All sorts of things going on. Okay. One other thing that we've discovered about dopamine, and we'll talk about it a little bit more if I get into Parkinson's disease before the end of the hour, is the idea of the fact that dopamine is a trigger of the chemoreceptor trigger zone, the CTZ, chemoreceptor trigger zone of the medulla. And what does the chemoreceptor trigger zone trigger? The vomiting center. So dopamine, typically, if you were to administer it, produces nausea and vomiting. Chemoreceptor trigger zone gets stimulated. We're blocking it. So it was discovered fairly early on that phenothiazines were fairly good antiemetics. Some of them a lot more so than others. In fact, one of the original compounds, compound by the trade name of Copacine, which is on that sheet that I handed out, I think, one of the original Smith-Kline compounds, found better utility as an antiemetic than it did as an antipsychotic, both orally, but of course if you're antiemetic, that presumes that you've got emesis going. I mean, you don't take an antiemetic just on a lark, you probably got emesis, so you don't take Compazine orally. How is it usually administered? Either parenterally or as a suppository. Okay? Antiemetic effect. So, some good things about dopaminergic blockade, some bad things. So, one final thing I want to mention is I don't want to beat this too much to death, but the other thing at the bottom of the front page that you've got on your handout is the fact that we also, there it is up there, We also discovered that there were dopaminergic autoregulatory receptors, very much like the serotonergic autoreceptors that I've talked about before. Presynaptic autoreceptors that were there for negative feedback purposes to inhibit further dopamine release from the neuron. And so often the effect that we want is delayed in onset because we have to desensitize these autoregulatory receptors, very much like with the serotonin, okay? So there was that issue as well. But the paradigm, of course, as I've indicated more than once already, was all about blockade of dopamine. After all, what have I got up here? Dopamine and psychosis. And then come a set of drugs where we break out of the box, break out of this paradigm. They're called the atypical antipsychotics. And they're atypical, initially at least, in the fact that they didn't have all of these side effects that I've been talking about, all of these issues, if you will, that the older style, what are now known as the classical antipsychotics, have. So we've got atypicals. They started appearing on the market in the mid to late 1990s. And they're basically an offshoot off of our research into depression and antidepressant compounds. Okay. We kept making better phenothiazines and phenothiazine derivatives. They didn't do the job as well as we would like them to. So we started looking at other molecules and other ways to do the job. The guy wants to shoot it and have to go home. Well, that would be a shame. It was these new compounds that really broke us out of the paradigm. I'll just put a few of them up for you. This is not necessarily the order in which they came to market, but they all come to market within about 3-4 years of each other. This is just a partial listing of what's available. Until you get down to here, there were 4 or 5 original ones. First is Clozaril or Clozapine, Risperdal or Risperidone, Olanzapine or Zyprexa, and Seroquel or Quetiapine. And they start becoming used quite a bit. And as they become used, there are issues. A new set of issues. Issues that we don't typically associate with dopaminergic blockade. Issues like the fact that Clozaril, which became the most popular one, at least initially, you'll notice that 2% up there, that is the incidence of agranulocytosis. For those of you that are mathematically challenged, that's saying 1 in 50. We've got agranulocytosis. The big thing about risperidone was hypotension, unrelated to alpha blockade. Just a significant hypotension. Olanzapine, and to a certain degree Seroquel, have been associated with significant weight gain. So there's something about the satiety center. People on these drugs are always hungry. And all of them tended to have real issues in terms of consistency of blood levels. So that we're always running into trouble in terms of trying to maintain an adequate antipsychotic effect. The one where the pens are, Cerelect, has tended to fall into disfavor, in this country at least, because of the fact that it is, among these five, the one with the most severe ability in terms of cardiac depression. That quinidine-like effect that I talked about with tricyclic antidepressants, to a lesser degree, the phenothiazine show up, but now this one shows up big time again. And so there are all sorts of cardiac issues associated with this depression, this ability to negatively impact the electronics and the muscular activity in the heart. Issues. But one of the things that we discovered was that indeed they were antipsychotic. And for some reason, the antipsychotic activity, the effectiveness, the efficacy of these compounds was not related to their ability to block D2 receptors. That is, they don't fit as nicely on this picture that I've got for the older compounds. They aren't on this titration curve, or titration line, if you will. They fall all over the place. And it got us into the idea, a paradigm shift, if you will, that maybe there are ways of dealing with psychosis that don't rely just on blockade of dopamine receptors and influencing these two nerve tracts that come from the reticular activating system, from the midbrain. And the compound then that breaks the roof off, if you will, is a compound that first comes on the market in 2002, aripiprazole, Abilify, and a couple of others that have come on the market since then. There are some others as well. And the big thing about Abilify, first of all, is while it was originally put on the market as an antipsychotic, very quickly we discovered that it is very useful adjunctively in the control of bipolar disorder. Its best efficacy, did you get the word adjunct? Seems to be in combination with low-dose lithium to treat bipolar disorder, manic depression. There is some evidence that says once we've got our manic depression under control, we can remove the lithium, and the Abilify by itself will be a good maintenance agent. Now, I wouldn't guarantee that that's going to keep going, but at least there's some initial evidence to that idea. In addition, the combination of Abilify and valproic acid has been found effective in bipolar disorder. And the Villify is also the compound now that tends to be the first one we go to in an acute manic attack. A unipolar condition, somewhat rare, but every once in a while it occurs, particularly in a bipolar individual. You've got to get the person off of this mania. And that seems to be the drug of choice now. And what's interesting about Abilify is that its major, while it's got some activity in other receptors, for instance, this is a partial agonist, both an agonist and antagonist, at our D2 receptor. So yeah, it does have some dopaminergic activity. Its major activity seems to be as an antagonist at serotonin receptor 5-HT2A or alpha. This particular receptor, 5-HT2-alpha, was discovered to be the primary receptor responsible for the agonist activity of psychedelic drugs such as lysergic acid, diethylamide, LSD. Psychedelic hallucinations, psychotic activity. With LSD, how do you block it? Block that receptor. And as a result, we started looking at that receptor as perhaps not only anti-hallucinogenic, but maybe anti-psychotic. And one of the things we've discovered then is that some of these atypical antipsychotic, well, not some of them, all of them, have at least some activity in terms of being an antagonist at this particular receptor. So all of these that I have labeled up here, these atypical drugs, if you will, tend to have some activity in this area. And so one of the ways in which we use the word atypical now is for the fact that their mechanism of action is atypical, at least in terms of the paradigm that we've been used to. What was that old paradigm? To be antipsychotic, you had to be blocking D2 receptors. Now, well, that might help, but there are other ways to skin the cat. Maybe it's not just blocking dopamine 2, but maybe if we find something that will block serotonin 2-alpha receptors will also have an effective compound. But you understand that this opens up a kind of a Pandora's box. Because I took some time to explain that old, here's what causes psychosis mechanism, that double negative thing. Did I mention serotonin receptors as part of that at all?
Nope.
So now the question becomes, how does stimulation of these receptors by compounds like LSD or maybe other naturally occurring compounds, you know, one of the big questions is, I'll just put this parenthetically, hopefully it's something you've already thought about, if you find a receptor, I'll be humble. Pulse receptor. I found something. You know, you find a receptor. Okay, the first question that you should ask is, what's it there for? What's the naturally occurring agonist? The body ain't dumb. It doesn't just throw out fake receptors to fool us. They're there for a purpose. So one of the key key questions is, okay, agonist activity at the serotonin receptor produces hallucination, psychedelic activity, and it seems like blockade will make us antipsychotic, or at least help in the control of psychosis. What is the natural scheme, what is the natural idea underlying stimulation of this receptor? What's it there for? What kind of teeter-totter is it all about? And so these atypical compounds are producing not only some good therapeutic activity, not only again as antipsychotics, but also in the control of manic depressive disease. Okay, but they're also, because of their atypical nature, producing a lot of questions that are in the research pipeline, even as we sit here. The condition is known as paralysis agitans. More commonly known as Parkinson's disease. It's kind of a dichotomy of words. Agitated paralysis. Think about that. Agitated paralysis, which tends to describe the idea that we have a lot of movement even while we're paralyzed. Okay. Agitated paralysis. My father-in-law suffered from Parkinson's disease for about the last 15 years of his life. While they were getting better at it, particularly in the fast-progressing forms, it tends to be so insidious in onset that we miss it. It was first diagnosed while he and my mother-in-law were wintering in Florida one year. He tripped a couple of times while he was walking on a level ground, stumbled, I guess, and said he was not feeling that well, so wife took him into the local hospital, which was, they were wintering down south of Gainesville. She took him to University of Florida Hospitals where, yeah, he was diagnosed. And after the diagnosis, my mother-in-law, the wife, said, yeah, he's been kind of acting strangely. They started talking about early symptoms. Yeah, he's been exhibiting these things for 2 or 3 years now. So he was already a couple of years into the whole idea before he was even diagnosed. What is it that we diagnose? What kinds of symptoms are there that tend to let us understand that the person is suffering from Parkinson's disease? Well, generally, it's all about movement. And some of the signs, symptoms of Parkinson's disease. Most of you know about the resting tremor. It usually begins in the contralateral arm and hand. But not necessarily. It can occur in the dominant. It can also occur in one of the feet initially. But usually, where is it? The non-dominant contralateral hand, and it's this. Okay? That's a common symptom. Tremor. Another symptom is known as cogwheel rigidity. Okay, it is a term used to describe what starts happening in terms of movement. Where am I here? There we are. used. God, that's good. Either in clocks or in grinding flour mill. But this is a wheel, and generally the cogs were either on the same plane or a 90-degree plane, but they look like this, right, and so on around. You know, this is Van Gogh's impression of a cog wheel. You know, and the cogs interlock and the wheels turn, right? Generally, the first cog in line, at least in a mill, is run by a water wheel and an axle cog, and then all the cogs feed off of that, run. Okay? But the problem is, they're made out of wood initially, wood wears. So every once in a while, you would get to the point where the cogs wouldn't interlock properly and there would be slippage. Okay? And you'd jerk. And that's very common then with what happens in a Parkinson's patient. Instead of the movement being like this, smooth and natural, it starts looking like this. Okay? Very herky-jerky. How's that for medical terminology? And it tended to be disconcerting and very tough to overcome for the patient. The patient would try their damnedest to get the smoothness back. Wouldn't happen. The rigidity, the consistent, nice firing tended to be a problem. So we got the tremor, we've got the rigidity. The other thing that tended to come, and where my father-in-law started to be diagnosed, is postural issues. And I'll just take a couple minutes on that, and it'll be our segue to next Monday. Typically, as Parkinson's progresses, the patient gets the feeling that they are falling backwards. And so to compensate, what you start observing is a leaning forward. And it's not from the hips, it's from the ankles. So they'll kind of look like this. And what starts happening is, and this is the agitated paralysis, they will tell themselves, I want to go to that door. I want to go to that door. I want to go to that door. And yet, they're not going to the door. And then they would start going to the door. And instead of walking now, what do? In order to make sure they maintain their balance, they start this, shuffling. Okay? And what then occurs in the later stages of the disease is, there's a wall here, I need to stop. I need to stop. I need to stop. And you know how they stop? They run into the wall. They run into the wall. And as I've suggested, the problem, it's all about that D1 nerve tract coming from the midbrain up to the extrapyramidal, the fine-tuning system of movement. Again, drive carefully over the holiday, and we'll see.